Hail and well met, friends. Welcome yonder to Casual Trek, normally a Star Trek ranking and review podcast. But today, we're doing something a little more casual than Trek, but Trek is still involved tangentially. My name is Miles Reed-Lobato, a science fiction writer and a lover of occasional fine brandies.
Hey doll, merry doll, merry doll, my darling. Hello, I'm Tom Bombadil.
Fuck off, Tom.
Oh.
Take your yellow boots and your attractive wife and piss off.
Hey, I'm Charlie Etheridge Nunn. There was a slightly less jolly than usual looking fellow walking out of here. You're right.
Yeah, I'm fine.
Good, good. I gather we're not doing an actual Star Trek casual trek today.
No, it's when Star Trek is your casual fandom, and then you think, hey, I'm going to do a podcast where I have to watch Star Trek every week, and then talk about it. Surprisingly enough, do you know what happens?
Mm-hmm.
You get burnt out on Star Trek.
Star Trek is good. And I think about it a lot more now, especially since starting this podcast. But I get that. We get a bit of a backlog of things we need to be doing as far as watching episodes and taking notes and getting things together. And last time we had a nice chat about having a lovely walk. I don't know what it says about us, but that was, for a time, one of our highest listened to episodes.
See, I think it's just people enjoying listening to us talking about buying Ket.
Of course. Well, maybe they need to know where to go, and it's still the level in Brighton.
So, today we are going to be talking about that other great story about trekking, J.R.R. Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, now when I think of a big long walk, especially wandering on the South Downs, there is something very, I don't know, very Tolkien about it. I feel increasingly like a hobbit in my old age. So wandering over hills and going, oh, that looks dangerous, let's not do that, seems to be a lot more my vibe. Basically, if a hobbit wore a loud shirt and had some facial hair, that's pretty much me these days.
Do hobbits have facial hair? I think hobbits have facial hair.
I think they do. I mean, the ones we saw in the films and we read about in the books didn't seem to, or at least I didn't remember them having proper beards, but they were just kids, hobbit-wise. Oh God, does this mean I'm more like Farmer Maggot or any of those older hobbits. This was supposed to be casual fun about Lord of the Rings. I wasn't supposed to have an existential crisis.
Look, it's Lord of the Rings. Eventually, you end up either having a existential crisis or try and think about hidden Catholic subtext.
True. So, Miles, how did you first encounter Lord of the Rings?
I encountered it first from The Hobbit, which, like, I think I was introduced to by my parents, and my stepfather, Phil, read me The Hobbit at bedtime. And then we progressed to Lord of the Rings, but due to life being how it was, he got as far as reading up to them meeting the Riders of Rohan, and then it just kind of, life got few and far between, so I ended up just reading the book myself.
Ah.
Which, you know, Lord of the Rings is a great book, but I don't think it's one that you kind of read to children at bedtime, because there's a lot happening in Fellowship of the Ring. When it gets to the Two Towers, there's a lot not happening, especially when the two stories diverge. You do get double the walking.
Yeah, which I've read Lord of the Rings three times, all in all, and similar to yourself, I was read The Hobbit as a young kid on a very rainy holiday with my mum and my brother, and she read that to us and then gave me a copy of Lord of the Rings because she was a massive, massive Tolkien nerd, and that became kind of a core thing. Like, there was this ancient yellow kind of compilation edition thing that was so old and falling apart that I had to be bought my own copy of the trilogy. And then when my brother was getting to a point where he wanted to read it, I gifted him that and got a new kind of a nice kind of box set version of it for myself. So we've had it handed down here. And yeah, I think Fellowship and Half of Two Towers is what I read in my first stab at it. And that must have been, I don't know, 10, maybe a couple years earlier than that. And it took me a few years to try it and get all the way through. And it was definitely a core thing. Like, my mum painted Rivendell on one of my walls of my bedroom when I was a child.
That's awesome. I was a huge, like, I think Tolkien was my big gateway into fantasy, and I think I was introduced to it around about the same time I was introduced to Star Wars, to Doctor Who, and then I think at the same time I was also being introduced to Discworld. But I was young enough that I was being introduced to Terry Pratchett through, like, the Truckers, the Gnomes books he wrote for kids, and, like, the Johnny Maxwell, like, Only You Can Save Mankind, and then getting into Discworld through that, and of course, like, Hitchhikers. Like, I was introduced to all this stuff very much at the same time, like, in the early 90s when I was hitting, like 8 to 10.
Yeah, I think it was a bit more slower and drip-fed with us. Like, for us, it was definitely the Narnia to Middle-earth pipeline.
You see, for me, it was Middle-earth came first. Then I tried to read Narnia, and I couldn't get into the Narnia books. Like, if I was much more, if I wanted to, I could kind of lie and say that I kind of saw the Catholic apologia straight away and went, no, not for me. But honestly, nah, the books just didn't work. Like, I think it was a kind of fantasy which just doesn't work for me, because it does kind of feel very safe and twee.
I forget how old I was when my brother and I first encountered it. And it was one of those things where we quite liked it. Didn't really have much context going from fairy tales to Narnia.
Yeah.
And then, from Narnia to Middle Earth, and got really into fantasy. And for me, last time we did a kind of casual trek, I was saying about, you know, loving nice long walks all over the place. And it is that thing where those walks, those wanders all around the countryside, mixed with the memory and the love of Middle Earth, of Tolkien's worlds, blended together into that state of going, I want to tell stories about, like, I want to have interaction in this kind of a world. And obviously, you know, in this day and age, you can go, right, I will play Skyrim, I will wander around a fancy countryside. And in fact, God, for many Christmases, whenever we had like a Zelda game or anything, my mum would just get merrily stoned while watching us playing games in Hyrule. And again, and like, same with Oblivion later on, and going, you know, just merrily enjoying this sort of odd other world. But for me, that kind of became where I started doing role-playing games. And of course, any of you that do D&D know 90% of the actions in it are fights. And people often equate that kind of D&D world with Tolkien world, and especially having played the One Ring role-playing game, you go, actually, it's kind of not. Like, when people get in fights, they get messed up. No,
Dungeons and Dragons definitely pulls more from your sword and sorcery, like your Jack Vance and your Robert Howard, and definitely very, very much so your Michael Moorcock. To the point where, like, earlier editions of Dungeons & Dragons have cribbed entire cosmologies from Moorcock until Moorcock started getting like, no. And Dungeons & Dragons then had to edit out the vast swaths of lore and chaos, which they very blatantly nicked.
Oh god, I own a copy of Deities and Demigods that has the Lovecraft mythos and the Moorcock mythos.
In as like a
pantheon you can use in your game before the lawyers got involved.
I've read Moorcock. I love Moorcock. The last thing I want to be doing is dealing with Ariok, because Ariok might be the one, like, evil demigod who, like, Elric tries to summon, and basically Ariok replies with a voice message going, not today, lol. Like, Ariok is a fantastic patron god, because Elric hates having to deal with him, and 9 times out of 10, Ariok is just like, yeah, no, I'm not helping you. And Elric goes, why? And Ariok goes, chaos, bitches, and just kind of skateboards out.
And to be honest, that kind of deity interaction, I think that's why I like a lot of the Greco-Roman kind of ancient gods, because they're a lot more fun in that respect. And you don't mess with them. Ideally, don't encounter them.
Just don't deal with them.
Yeah, just don't. Yeah, but...
like the title of that great film last year. Nope.
Exactly. So yeah, anyway, back on to Tolkien though. I don't know how recently you've read the Lord of the Rings trilogy.
I read it in 2021.
Oh wow. Okay. More recently for me then.
Yeah. 2021, my wife was very sick.
Yeah.
And as a way of kind of keeping sane, I said to myself, right, I'm going to try and read a book a week. And I ended up reading like 70 books. In the middle of the year, around about May, June, my wife was going in for surgery. And we were going to spend 2 weeks recovering from her surgery with her parents out of town. And so I thought, right, this will be a good time to reread Lord of the Rings. So I started reading it. I remember sitting in the lobby of the hotel in Madison, Wisconsin, reading the parts of the book where Frodo and Sam and the hobbits go into the old forest and meet Tom Bloody Bombadillo. Because I remember reading the chapter where the Black Riders attack Frodo's house in Cricklewood. Because there's the fifth hobbit who's cut out of all the adaptations.
Oh, Fatty Bulger.
Fatty Bulger, who,
He was in one of the board games, just in case you had a fifth player. And it was very much whoever was last was going to have to be him, because, yeah, he should have shown up earlier, got an actual name-level person, but...
But yeah, so I remember the chapter where the Black Riders attack Frodo's house and Fatty Bulger, which is one of those names you can only say in a kind of lower class English accent.
Wow. I admit I let my Brighton out there.
Fatty Bulger.
Yeah.
Sorry, it's Fatty.
Fatty Bulger.
Fatty Bulger, is that you?
Oh, God. Yeah. No hard T's in there at all.
No. At the same time, Fatty Bulger does also sound like a name you could say to someone you went to prep school with. It's like, oh, you meet him in the club, in the gentleman's club. You're like, oh, it's Fatty. Fatty Bulger. Remember, I gave you a record spanking back during Trig.
Fatty Bulger? Why, yes. He does have some horse for you.
Ah, here we are. I found it. Chapter 9, Knife of the Dark. Yup, it is called Crick Hollow. And yep, and Fatty Bulger. Page 193, Fatty Bulger runs away and not to be seen until, like, the very end of the book. But, so yeah, I was reading the early chapters And then I think I finished the rest of the book within 3 days. Like, I spent quite a few summer mornings sitting out on the porch in Eau Claire, and Rihanna's parents' house is very much out of the way. So there's a very nice bit of grassland. It's just really quiet out there. And I remember reading, like, the parts of the book, Gandalf and Pippin at Minas Tirith, and was it Merry? I get these all bloody confused. It's really quite embarrassing. It's Pippin, and he's in Minas Tirith being trained as a soldier, and meeting more characters who we never see in the films or the radio play, and just reading like the fantastic the Battle of the Plenor Fields.
Oh my god. That, like, revisiting that and having a lot more feelings and attitudes about war. Like, I did at like 11, or in my second read even at around 20. And that thing of it's always been said about you can't do a war film that's anti-war, even if it is textually saying it's anti-war, because war looks kind of cool. You know, it looks dramatic and all that, but there are definitely exceptions,
I definitely think that the one great anti-war film I've ever seen is Johnny Got His Gun, which is based on a novel by Dalton Trumbo, which I feel does anti-war really well. Then, of course, you have adaptations of books like Catch-22 and Slaughterhouse-5, which I feel do really well on making war look unglamorous. I always think that when it comes to fantasy, and definitely fantasies where people have imitated Tolkien, I think Tolkien writes battles. You know, you read his description of battles and warfare, and it's unglamorous. It is dirty. It is bloody.
I mean, that's definitely, my takeaway with that, and even with the Scouring of the Shire, of going, these are damaged people. These are people that have been through shit. You go through a massive war, and if you are lucky, then you are a broken person. If not, then you are one of the nameless masses of dead that are there. And of course, Tolkien always said he didn't care for allegory or anything like that, but I think we can all know an amount of what's gone on here, or what informed his imagination.
Well, you know, there's a difference between, I think people take the allegory, the I don't write allegory part out of context, because I feel that the Tolkien saying I don't write allegory is very much used by people, especially these days, who like to complain about books, about films and media being too political. I always find that there is a very good chunk of people on the right who are trying to claim Lord of the Rings as like a very conservative text.
Ugh.
I feel when Tolkien says I don't write allegory, I feel like he is comparing his book to something like the Chronicles of Narnia, which is very much dripping in allegory.
Yeah,
because you're a writer. I'm a writer, and it's like you read a book, you read anything, any work of fiction, and you can tell for the most part a writer's beliefs over how he frames the heroes, how he frames the villains, how he frames the politics of within the story going on. And Tolkien is definitely drawing, if only subconsciously, on his World War I experiences. Because especially with chapters like when Gollum is leading Frodo and Sam through the dead marshes on the way to Mordor, and you have the pools which are filled with the bodies of dead soldiers for a long, long ago war. And you can't help but think of No Man's Land. Yeah. Of just a world of blood, ash, and death.
It's definitely been interesting to see and revisit. I guess, God, what, the last time I read it was 2018. And I remember reading it and constantly going, 20-year-old Charlie was a dick.
Yeah.
Like, 20-year-old Charlie had so many of those attitudes about fantasy, about, you know, like, I'd got sickened by so many D&D novels where it was all so dry and tame and very, you know, kind of, I guess, a lot of the classical attitudes about D&D and all that, where it is this very formal Western fantasy where the status quo must always be upheld, and that is basically a vaguely American, European kind of Disney version of fantasy. And I, rereading Lord of the Rings, I realized I'd attributed an amount of blame when I gave up reading any fantasy at all for a while. And then, of course, got back to it with Game of Thrones and all of those kind of, ooh, it's dark fantasy. And, like, this is the good shit. It turns out that Tolkien guy, he's pretty good at words. Yeah,
like, I think the main, like, this is something my wife and I disagree on, is the ending of The Lord of the Rings. Because the end of, Rihanna doesn't really like the idea that Frodo goes through all this and never really finds happiness at home. And what I love the fact, and I feel that this is the thing that puts Lord of the Rings above its more conservative, small c imitators, is that it doesn't end with Frodo. It's not a restoration fantasy. It doesn't restore, like, the world is forever changed. It is, it's diminished.
Well, and they are forever changed.
They're forever changed. And Frodo comes home. I love the line, I have saved the Shire, but it was not saved for me.
Yeah.
And, like, I love the fact that, you know, he can't find peace in the world he has saved, but Sam can. Sam can get married and have children, and he has good times ahead of him. Whereas Frodo is damaged for the world he sacrificed so much for, that he has to go away and find healing. He is shell-shocked in a way.
Yeah, well, that's the thing with all of these, kind of, with the return of the Hobbits. And revisiting it when I was 38 was, I think, the first time that it clicked for me as a good and kind of necessary part, because we see them leaving the Shire, and upon returning, they are all different, they are all changed. And when you get this kind of, this overthrow of the Shire and the Hobbits who have been through so much, and even though they're so small, they come back, they are like the A-team, almost, compared to everything else that is there. It's this final last hurrah for that side of them. But then how many of them can actually ever go home again? And when you get someone like Frodo, you go through traumatic events and you are a different person. The person you were before is dead. And unfortunately for Frodo, there's no kind of...
There's no peace.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's a part of him, I think, he's fine with that. He finds some happiness vicariously through, you know, Sam getting married and settling down and having kids. But at the end of the day, he's still, every year, he's still pained by the loss of his finger, and he still of the pain of being stabbed on Weathertop. Those wounds are with him forever.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and it's not, I guess, as someone that grew disillusioned with primarily that heroic, arcadey kind of fantasy of D&D and of the varied Dragonlance and Forgotten Realm novels and all that, you don't have a potion of healing. You don't have a cleric doing D8 healing or doing a resurrection spell or anything like that. You see what these people go through. There's a role-playing game, and it was the first role-playing game that I did in person after lockdown, and I thought it would be a relevant one, and it's called Back Again from the Broken Land. And it's powered by the Apocalypse game. It's a very short kind of zine length sort of thing. And the idea is you are small people that were in part of a massive battle, that were in part of a massive fight between good and evil, and what they've titled the Doom's Lord, the kind of Sauron type figure, is defeated. And you were people involved in some way, and you're going home. And the game is played through this journey from that blasted battlefield and bit by bit through the land. And you each have burdens. Some you write down initially, and some you have as blank spaces that you will add as you go on. And when you stop and have a meal, when you talk to one another, you can find ways to kind of offload some of those burdens, to try and exorcise the demons that you've left that world with. And it was fascinating seeing some of the people that knew they weren't going to clear enough to have a nice epilogue. Like, you had that very varied, very mixed finale where one person had a really lovely life afterwards. They were able to change and grow. And watching the rituals and mechanics play with that idea of going, okay, do you grasp onto this so much that you can't ever leave that battlefield? And it was interesting seeing a game do that, especially given, you know, I think post-film, the bits of Lord of the Rings which were removed from the films, such as Bombadil and such as the Scouring of the Shire, tend to get short shrift a bit from folks.
Okay, first of all, that game sounds amazing. I don't think, after last year's, I don't think I'm emotionally ready to try and play a game like that, because I'm having to do it in real life.
100% get that.
Like, God, you don't know how hard it is when you've had, like, when you've been through something like cancer, that how much of your life has basically been taken up with that, and how much you just kind of lose being able to talk to other people about things. But yeah, when rereading Lord of the Rings, I realized how much of my perception of Lord of the Rings had been shifted by the films, for good and ill. And as much as I enjoyed the films, they don't capture what makes the book so powerful. And I feel like even where the films portray the horrors of what they've gone through, they still fall victim to that small C conservative viewpoint, even if it's not an intentional conservative viewpoint.
Yeah, that need for, as you say, that kind of almost restoration fantasy. Everything, all the toys are put back. Everything's fine. Our cause was just, and no ill will have come from. It is a gorgeous trilogy of films. I admit my family all made an executive decision to never bother with the Hobbit trilogy. Back when the Lord of the Rings ones came out, it was the Christmas event for my family to go out and see.
No, it was the same with my stepdad and I. Like, every Christmas, we went and saw each film. Like, that was our bonding experience over the Christmas holidays.
Yeah, God, I think we even roped some of my mum's friends into joining us as well. And the only time that felt bad was when we sat through all of the credits of Return of the King. But but yeah, that was a whole experience. And when the extended editions came out, I was living at home while being at university. And whenever my brother was down, we would watch extra features. We would watch a whole documentary or half a documentary or something like that.
The extended features for each film were my guaranteed Christmas present from my grandparents each year. and that was great. It's been so long since I've sat. It's been so long since I sat down and watched the films.
I think we did, the fancy Blu-ray box set thing was possibly one of the last Christmas presents from my mum. And we watched Fellowship and then didn't get round to watching the others. So when lockdown happened, we had, in this house, we had Friday night, junk food, and a film. And when we were starting to try and go, okay, what haven't we seen that we've meant to? And I'd never seen the extended Return of the King. So we ended up doing 3 weeks, 3 Fridays, each of those films, which was a really nice time, especially, you know, again, during lockdown where you're going, yes, I've seen one other human than like myself, my partner, the lodger, and a guy at the supermarket who's all masked up that will sling you your things.
And I kind of, sometimes I envy, given that I had to work a lot during, like, after the first, like, I was in lockdown for 6 weeks. And then I had to go back, to work and, no, I can go into a whole podcast of how COVID made Starbucks customers 20% shittier human beings, but like that's a less casual podcast and more of a I get drunk and angry on a Friday night and start ranting. Okay, quick question in terms of film adaptations of Lord of the Rings.
Okay.
Have you seen the Bakshi version?
When I was much, much younger, it was watching that my mum showed us that. I think it was on or the caravan we were staying at in a really rainy holiday had it or something. Like, it was there, and we saw it, and then my mum read us The Hobbit.
Okay, like, I watched it, like, my school.
Where were they in my school? Damn it.
Which was run by my form teacher.
Nerds!
Yup, Mr. Hickman. I went to Stringer, which is a fancy school. but yeah, we had to, like, two Fridays we watched during our lunch break, we watched the Bakshi version. And yeah. I enjoy it. Like, it's, as a piece of, like, as an animated fantasy film, it's fine.
Mm.
It's not as weird as Wizards, which was the kind of science fantasy film Bakshi did before he did Lord of the Rings. At the same time, it's not as fucked up as Fritz the Cat. And now I wish I could go back in. I wish I could go back in time and go to Mr. Hickman and go, listen, did you ever see this other film directed by Ralph Bakshi, Fritz the Cat? It'll blow your mind, dude.
Oh dear. Yeah. I think that was the only time I've ever seen it. The film Lord of the Rings stuff, I've seen maybe only a couple of times, despite always owning a copy. And it feels like something, much like the books, I should revisit more often, just because I love being in that space. Most of my encounters with Lord of the Rings these days are board games and RPGs, actually. I don't know if you've ever seen Fantasy Flight Games, their Lord of the Rings living card game, but that became kind of an addiction for us.
No, I've only ever played one Lord of the Rings related tangential game, and that is Lord of the Rings Part 1, open parentheses, there was never a Part 2, close parentheses.
Oh dear.
For the Super Nintendo, which was made by Interplay, who have made good games. They made Another World, or Out of This World, which is one of my favorite games of all time, and Flashback,
of course, which is a classic.
A classic, which is also evil. But this game, I swear, is unplayable. You start off as Frodo, and you can't leave Hobbiton until you've collected all three of your mates once more. Hashtag, we remember Fatty Bulger.
And never forget
Fatty Bulger. And so, like, you can get Merry really easily. Sam, you have to find the gaffer because the gaffer's gone missing. And so
of course,
the game is really slow. It's really unwieldy. And it has an early kind... If you had the Super Nintendo Link, so you can plug in multiple controllers for multiplayer, you could play the other hobbits and characters you get. Otherwise, the AI just has them walk around like fucking idiots, which is kind of true to the game, to the books anyway, where Merry and Pippin are just walking around, literally poking everything to see if it'll try and kill them.
Oh.
And sometimes while playing it, I've managed to get Merry or Pippin killed by an orc who is hanging around in this cave outside Hobbiton before I've even left Hobbiton.
Great. Wow.
Let me finish. I have to continue.
Yeah.
You get all four hobbits and you're allowed to leave town. And mm-hmm. if you leave town, there is a screen which has you go in either two directions, right or down. If you go right, you're attacked by black riders and will be killed instantly. If you go down, you start to make your way through like the old forest and like to get to and the Barrow Downs, and you meet Tom Bombadil. Tom Bombadil is in this game. And
yes.
And you go through this huge like 10-20 screens in level, like it's a huge long trek to get you to outside Bree. The screen before Bree is a screen where you got previously killed by the Black Riders.
Oh, great.
But the Black Riders are gone now because the game has railroaded you into mm-hmm. following how the game is meant to be played.
It sounds like it was a riveting time.
Oh, yeah. And then you get to Bree and you find Strider. But Strider won't join you unless you find, I think it's a letter from Gandalf, which is in a cave. Yeah. So you have to go to another bloody cave and fight a bunch of orcs. And if you die, game over. If Frodo dies, game over. You get the letter from Gandalf, you give it to Strider. Strider joins your party. And then you play as Strider for the rest of the game. Here's the thing though. Now Frodo is as dumb as Sam, Merry, and Pippin. And if Frodo dies, game over.
Game over.
And more tracking. You get to Rivendell, where you get Boromir and Gimli. And now you have to make your way to Moria. Have you noticed that we're missing two characters?
Oh, dear.
Yep, because you don't get Legolas or Gandalf until midway through Moria, where you're about to fight the Balrog.
Would they have been too useful? Or
I don't know.
Did they just not have the memory?
I am not sure. Because getting to Moria is a slog. And then when you get to fight the one and only boss, which is the Balrog, you've just got Gandalf on your party. Gandalf walks up to the Balrog and waves his fingers a few times and then dies.
Great. I mean, that's pretty accurate.
Yeah, pretty accurate. And when I beat the Balrog the one occasion, I think my only surviving members of the Fellowship were Aragorn, Frodo, and I think Sam. Everyone else had been killed by the Balrog because they basically walked up to the Balrog like British soldiers in No Man's Land towards machine gun fire. To go back to the World War One analogy. And you kill the Balrog and you leave Moria and you get to Galadriel. And she shows you the Mirror of Galadriel, and that is where the game ends. It is quite possibly the worst game I have ever played. And I have played games like RoboCop 3 for the Super Nintendo, or Faceball 2000 for the Super Nintendo. I have played some terrible games, but the Lord of the Rings game is possibly the worst game I have ever played. And I was waiting for that game for like 6 years.
Yeah, I'm shocked that we'd never played it, given we were a big SNES family.
Because this was a game which was being advertised and promoted from the moment the Super Nintendo, I think, came out in the UK. because I remember it being advertised in one of the many 90s video game magazines we had in the UK. I won't lie, when I finally got the game, which was mailed to me from my aunt in the US, and when I started to play it, and when I realized how terrible this game was, I may have started crying.
Wow. See, I think the only Lord of the Rings video game I've ever played was The Hobbit Text Adventure on the Commodore 64.
But, oh dear God, like, the game was terrible. Sometimes I've been tempted to do a convention panel about why this game is horrendous.
It's, yeah, it's evidently something that still haunts you. That you're still carrying, like some kind of missing finger.
Or some kind of magic ring.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Oh, dear. Yes, on the opposite side of things, I know my dad, my brother and I avidly played the Hobbit game on the C64, and I have zero memories, aside from it had colour pictures on it, which was more than a lot of the text adventures that we were playing at the time.
Oh, hang on, I've never played this game, but I feel nostalgic. Just looking at these screenshots. I was a ZX Spectrum kid.
Boo.
Oh, was this one of those games that I love telling people about the halcyon days of playing computer games on cassette tapes.
That was one that we had in. It was one of the only ones we had in a kind of VHS style clamshell case instead of the hard plastic, like, little rectangles. Yeah, so it always stuck out. That and Valhalla, which was another text adventure in an even more ludicrously large box. I think that is the only Lord of the Rings game I've played. I've not even done any of the Shadow of War type ones or anything like that, because it feels kind of sacrilegious. Almost going, oh, it's an Assassin's Creed, but Lord of the Rings.
I just
can't bring myself to.
No, that's kind of how I, that's kind of, I'm sure, like, I've heard it's a good game. Yeah. But there's this part of me that's just like, but that's not, like, Lord of the Rings isn't a game isn't the kind of story where you go around slaughtering lots of people and having it be cool. It's a game where you walk around having people slaughtered around you, and you feel really sad inside.
Oh dear! Oh god! Wanting the mumblecore fucking walking sim version of Lord of the Rings, and actually, I would play that. That's the sad thing. Like, as cynical as that is, I would.
I want the indie developer Lord of the Rings.
Yes. So yeah, for me,
or either that, or like Undertale, like Lord of the Rings done by the people who did Undertale.
Oh, that'd be great fun. Like, you could get away with doing it in a Telltale game. Oh, I realise I am lying. I've played some Lego Lord of the Rings. My brother and I.
Does that feel less or more sacrilegious?
Less, I think. Like, a little less. Thing is, it's Lord of the Rings, the movie, the Lego game, because it's one of the first Lego games that uses audio from the original source, which means you can't do it anymore. You can't get it anymore. Not new, at least, because of licensing things. Also, it is really jarring. Really, really jarring having, like, oh yeah, all of the Lego video game noises and people going ah and blowing apart when you accidentally hit them in Hobbiton, because your missions are still very Lord of the Rings,
yeah.
You know, at least as far as my brother and I have played, because we decided he had a copy, you can't get it elsewhere, and we always like doing a two-player thing. So on a hungover morning, whenever I crash around at his, we do another level or so. And it's all been fairly gentle and fairly fun. And then partway through, it will cut some audio from the film, and you can hear the background noise as well. It is so abruptly cut and so seriously delivered, because every line is so portentous in those films, that it feels so jarring. I would rather have had the mute early Star Wars Lego game characters than suddenly have Elijah Wood suddenly going, oh, this is all so terrible. It's like, I've been collecting giant plastic carrots. How terrible is it?
See, is it wrong that now I want a Lego Chronicles of Narnia?
That would... that could work.
No, because I want them to go as far as the last battle, where all the kids die in a train crash, and Susan doesn't get to go to Narnia because she likes pantyhose.
Yeah, that was weird. That was, C.S. Lewis, what? But no, this isn't C.S. Lewis Trek. But still, Jesus. Yeah, so for me, the main, as I said, I've
How does that
done
work?
Tabletop games. I actually have played some role-playing games set in that world, which again, could feel sacrilegious at times. So, the first one I played was Adventures in Middle-earth, a D&D 5th edition version of, like, a Middle-earth type game.
Yeah.
And I know at least one of the people who plays listens to this, so I'm going to be polite. It plays like Dungeons & Dragons plays, which is not how Lord of the Rings goes. I liked the company. I liked the people. The GM was very good, very nice. But at the same time, it all felt like we were murdering monsters, intimidating barkeeps, blustering around like the power fantasy lead characters that you get in that kind of thing, going, obviously, I'm in charge here. I'm a big damn hero. And it's like, this does not feel like Lord of the Rings. It feels like I just had to mentally exile anything thematic, because the closest it had were mechanics pulled from the One Ring role-playing game, which didn't really fit because it needed like four skills that only some of the classes had.
I feel like metagaming for Lord of the Rings would get really obnoxious really quickly, because you're gonna get that one guy who thinks he's clever by trying to get the eagles to fly you everywhere. And while this is a casual style podcast, I am going to no, Gandalf could not have gotten the eagles to fly him to Mordor so he can drop the ring into Mount Doom. The eagles are a proud people, and every time Gandalf has had to call on them for help, it has not been done lightly or willingly. And also, the eagles could not have flown to Mordor because the Nazgul have their own flying steeds.
Well, yeah, the thing about their hobbits is they're not noticeable.
Yeah.
They are little. They're down there. If you fly along with a big eagle, doesn't matter how quick your eagle is, they're going to get noticed. They're going to get stopped. Eagle theory, no.
To go to Star Wars, like, the reason, like, yes, the X-Wings are going to fly in, the X-Wings and Y-Wings are going to fly into the trench. At the same time, they get noticed flying in there pretty damn quickly.
Yeah, yeah. See, if there was more walking in Star Wars, we could even have done one of these Trek talks about Star Wars. But no. So, with Lord of the Rings, the thing I'll say, Adventures in Middle-earth really switched me off and was the final Dungeons and Dragons that I played. I've written all of that off because, yeah, I'm kind of done with that. The One Ring, on the other hand, I'm currently in a campaign of, and it's the same GM, and it's mechanics that encourage theme.
Ooh.
We have patrons. We're currently working for Círdan the Shipwright, although there were some moments where we realised Círdan also means shipwright, so it's Shipwright the Shipwright. We've tried not to make fun of him for that, but...
Do you think he's Círdan the Shipwright, son of Círdan the Shipwright?
Oh, that'd be amazing.
Like, you know, he, like, his great-granddad called himself Círdan, and then he just fought to name his kid Círdan. as kind of a gag to be kind of a dick. But then he never told his kid what Seadun means because he felt bad about it in later age. So that when his grandson, his also called Seadun, he realizes, shit, sunk cost fallacy has now set in. I can't tell my son anything.
Yeah, you just have to commit for a bit. Yep, at that point.
Pretty much.
So, like, we played the starter set for the One Ring, and something I love about this starter set, right? For basic big core rulebook, you can play people from Bree, from Gondor, from, you know, you can play elves from a couple of different places, dwarves, all of that. The starter set, you are just hobbits. And it's got some pre-made hobbits. It's got a lovely map of the Shire. And as a starter set, the idea of starting zoomed in at this very small level, this small kind of starter area. Like, we had some nice little journeys. We had to do a little bit of liberating of things for old Bilbo, who was our patron. And we stopped off at a pub, met some dwarves, chatted with some dwarves.
Oh, no.
I had some scones.
Ooh.
Like, it was a nice time. We stayed at a farm and chased an owl out of a barn. It was exactly what I wanted.
I really hope that you were playing like Lord of the Howard Shore soundtrack to kind of keep in the mood. And while you were chasing the owl out, it's one of the dramatic choral bits of music, like for the big battles or a big monster just turned up.
Oh, that would have been great. This was all online and it was tonally, it felt like the low-level adventures hobbits would have. And now that we're playing actual created characters, I'm playing like a big himbo Bjorning, who is not very smart, but he's good at violence, and he's got all the materials for a very nice picnic.
Ooh.
Yeah, he's been a nice lad. And we've not had enough of a sense of each other's characters to go, we're BFFs yet, but we've been having some fun with it, and it feels like a game that works with the themes and ideas of Tolkien's style, like fantasy and the nature and the kind of, again, the weird patrons that are beyond our knowing. Like, you can't make a Gandalf, but you can work for a Gandalf, or Radagast, or all sorts of people. Like, oh God, yeah, have to do like pet hospital type missions.
Okay, I like Radagast, but only because in the Hobbit films, like, Radagast is the best part for me in the Hobbit films, because it's great to see Sylvester McCoy in, like, a big budget Hollywood movie.
I figured.
Look, they give Radagast a moment in the first film to deliver a line about evil from the dawn of, like, evil existing from the dawn of time, and it's just like, you know what? You know what Sylvester McCoy is really good at doing? Speeches about Lovecraftian evils from beyond the dawn of time. I need more. I need an H.P. Lovecraft Cthulhu movie just so I can get Sylvester McCoy to play like a professor at Arkham talking about the Necronomicon.
Actually,
that'd be kind of awesome. I want a Dunwich horror movie where he plays one of the professors at Arkham talking about like the evil texts.
Trying to warn some poor student or some unfortunate nephew who's inherited something awful to not read the books, to turn back and of course be ignored, but he would try anyway.
He would try anyway. But yeah. I picked up the audiobooks read by Andy Serkis a couple of months ago when they're on sale on Audible, and I have been tempted to give them. I've been tempted, even though it's been relatively soon, recent since I last read Lord of the Rings, I'm kind of tempted to give it a listen.
Yeah, I've no idea what those ones are like, but Andy Serkis is always good fun.
It might be the only way I will ever get through the Silmarillion is if I if I download the audiobook and then listen to it at 1.5 speed.
Oh my God, that might... Yeah, I might have to do similar. I am the only person in this house who has not read The Silmarillion. So when Rings of Power was first announced and we'd watched the films and all that, Emma, my partner, who is incredibly well-read, and Lee, my lodger, who doesn't really do books much. And, you know, that's fine, really. Both are incredibly well versed in the Silmarillion. Both of them are, like, went into such lore. And I'm like, yeah, I was raised by a Lord of the Rings fan, had Rivendell on my wall. Big, big fan of it. No, I don't read any of the Apocrypha. No, I've not read any of the side stuff. Immediately getting these incredible kind of lectures on all of the mythology. And, like, Lee wouldn't watch Rings of Power specifically because of all of that. And Emma and I think gave it about 3 episodes. And as funny as Elrond being awful is, we just couldn't be bothered, really. It was a lot of very pretty stuff. And it did that Heroes type TV show problem of every episode gives you 5 to 10 minutes of a bunch of different characters. None of this feels connected, and it's not really doing much aside from getting everyone from point A to point B. Point B will be a cliffhanger at the end of a season for next season, where there'll be a new point A to point B for most of them.
I haven't actually watched The Rings of Power. Eventually I'll get around to it. But then again, there's so much TV I actually need to get around to watching anyway.
Yeah, it's one that, I don't know, I was given the okay by Emma to go ahead and watch the rest of it myself. And then I couldn't be bothered. And I want to. Like, I want to see the rest of it. I want to see if it improves. I've had the twist kind of element of it ruined. But that's not really, I'm not too fussed about that. So, yeah, I don't know. One day, there'll be few enough things that I get excited to watch it or just get it over with. I get the feeling it's going to be that latter kind of feeling. And yeah, at the moment though, what I've been enjoying, because I couldn't find on the UK streaming services that I subscribe to a copy of the extended edition of any of the films, there's a site called Forble, which has the BBC audio drama in a level where you can have it as a podcast feed. I mean, there are a bunch of other like Radio 4 type shows or anything like that, but so I've subscribed to some but as podcasts. But this, I've got most of the way through Fellowship of the Ring today, and it's been a joy. Ian Holm is so good as Frodo.
The BBC radio adaptation is probably my favorite adaptation of the books. Like, it captures the tone, the mood, the music is wonderful, the acting is great.
Don't get me wrong, they score slightly lower with me because there's no Fatty and there's no Tom Bombadil.
Okay, but, yes, you know, yes, I'll live with yes, that. But like, you know, judging Lord of the Rings adaptations on whether or not they include Tom Bombadil and Fatty Bulger are few and far between.
Yeah, yeah. The Rainer Knizia board game, the co-op board game, which I think was my first cooperative board game that I played, had Fatty Bulger, but it wasn't great. Like, it's fine, but was very much an early kind of board game. But yeah, it's been a joy listening to it for the first time in possibly decades after my mum borrowed it from friends and taped every single one. That was a long quest. And I think it was during the recording of it, when we were kids, that was the last time that I heard this.
Like, I had that really nice kind of box of it, the nice black long box.
Yes.
Which my parents bought for me from Wax Factor.
Oh, wow.
And that's currently in probably on a shelf in Brighton somewhere. Like, probably still in my parents' house. Like, I managed to pick it up cheap on CD over here. But it's been a while. I keep meaning to listen to it. But just, I have so much to it's that thing. I have so much to listen to.
Well, yeah. Yeah, the week we're recording this, Cerebro launched an 18-hour episode about Madeline Pryor. And that is stupid and crazy.
And you're in.
And I mean, I'm like an hour in already. Yeah. It's... But for the moment, I'm going to listen to Lord of the Rings first, which might be longer, might be shorter.
I think it might be shorter.
Just, It might just be slightly shorter, yes. Oh, dear. Anyway, speaking of which, I ought to go off and do that.
Because you know how we said this is going to be the quick and easy episode, the casual episode? We're over an hour. So, it's shorter than our normal episodes go, but still.
Yeah, it's a lighter one than our Star Trek ones, which we'll get back to in the very near future.
And to that, I will have to say that Casual Trek is part of the Nerd and Tie podcast network. You can find us on Twitter, but why would you want to? And here is the thing. If the Star Trek episode where they talk about Lord of the Rings is your first introduction to Casual Trek, you know what? Good for you. Brave of you to start here. If this is your first episode and you're wondering why the hell we've not mentioned Star Trek at all, well done. Thank you for making it this far. Please continue to listen to our fine output. And also, I have to say, in the tradition of all elves, Numarie, which is the Elvish word for greeting and for farewell, which meaning literally be well.
And I will just say, fly, you fools!